Hello and welcome to the Mindset Growth Academy podcast. I'm your host, Emma Gibbs-Ung. Each show, I'm going to be using a combination of interviews with incredibly inspiring people from around the world who have achieved greatness, overcome adversity, and never given up, as well as solo episodes from me sharing my own journey as a leading mindset coach, helping to inspire, support, and guide you to create a growth mindset so you can achieve success in all areas of your life. Are you ready to bring mindset to life and create success from the inside out? Let's go. Hello and welcome back to the Mindset Growth Academy podcast. Today I'm joined by Adam Holyoake. Adam is a professional athlete who is the only international cricketer to compete professionally as a mixed martial arts artist. He has also competed as a professional boxer. However, he's most well known as a cricketing all-rounder who played for Surrey in England. During the peak of his career, Adam tragically lost his brother, Ben Holyoake, who was also an international cricketer, in a car accident. Today, Adam will be sharing with me the impact this loss has had on his life, both personally and professionally, how he coped with the grief while competing for his country, and what it taught him as a person. So Adam, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm absolutely blessed that you have agreed to come on to my show. There's so much that I want to talk to you about. I don't really know where to begin. It's lovely having you here, so thank you.
No problem. Pleasure to be on.
All the way over in sunny Australia as well, as I'm sat here in a thick jumper 1 week till Christmas. But Adam, I mentioned in the introduction, obviously you have achieved huge success in the sporting world with cricket, boxing, martial arts, but you've also reinvented yourself a number of times since your retirement, working for charity for the Ben Holyoake Foundation, property development, and now coaching yourself. There is literally, I've got pages of questions here, whether we get through them, I don't know, but would you mind just starting off, just sharing with me a bit about how you first got into cricket? And what it meant for you to be playing for your country alongside your brother?
Yeah, I mean, I was probably like any other kid who just starts out playing in the backyard. I had a brother who is younger than me, and we travelled a lot with my dad's work, so we travel around. So he and I became very close, and often we were in non-English-speaking countries, so we had to play games in the garage or on our knees in the lounge room, breaking all mum's stuff. So we had to find ways of playing. I mean, we didn't have PlayStation or anything like that because we were traveling a lot. So often sport was just the way we did it. And he was 6 years younger than me. He was literally my only friend growing up there. So he grew up very quick. I probably stayed immature, but we built a bond and then also became very competitive with one another as well. And that's my first memory of cricket. And then obviously I went through the same route as everybody else. I was played school cricket, club cricket, etc., etc. So
obviously you were born in Australia, weren't you, and then you moved to the UK. So did your cricketing career really take off in Oz, or was it more when you came over to England?
It was probably more when I had played a little bit. Just I think I played 3 or 4 games of cricket before I came to England, but I certainly wasn't ready to make the team at the age of 12. So I was just like any other 12-year-old. I was starting out, playing my first couple of games. I was mainly a rugby player, preferred rugby as a kid, and I just liked all sport. So it wasn't like I came over to England with the intention of making it as an international cricketer. It was just another game. Which we played everything, like chess, like bouncing balls, getting handball, our own concoction of games. So it wasn't like I set out with the intention of being an international cricketer, especially at the age of 12. I didn't know what I wanted to do.
So when did you start to realise that you could end up representing your country and be a well-known cricketer and all-rounder for not just obviously England, for Surrey, and you captained the team as well? So when did that start to become, hang on, this is more than just me being into sport because that's what I've always done, to actually I could really make a good go of this?
I guess it happened. I think it pretty much happened that I got asked to be a professional because I really had no intention of becoming a professional cricketer. I knew I wanted to play sport for a living, but I was a far better rugby player than I was a cricketer. Rugby wasn't professional at that stage. And I just, Greg, who was the captain of Surrey, this time, came down to the school where I was, St George's, and said he wanted to have a meeting with me. I didn't know who Ian Greg was. I knew who Tony Greg was, who was his brother, but he came down and said he wanted to meet me. And the next minute, he was offering me a contract. Wow. I didn't know what the contract was. I was like, he's just giving me a bit of paper. And then on it said that I was going to be getting £3,000 to play cricket, which at the time I was on, I think I was on £5 a week pocket money. So I thought I'd won the lotto. So, and I don't have to study anymore. So it wasn't a very hard decision. My option was carry on studying, which I hated, or take up this position earning an absolute fortune as a professional cricketer. So I don't think it was necessarily something I wanted to plan, but I'm pretty stubborn. And as soon as I became professional, I then wanted to be the best at it that I could be. Yeah. So that's when I realised, hey, if I get good at it, then I saw some of the other guys were doing well. And that's when I realised my path to being good and famous, successful at cricket, became evident once I got signed on as a professional.
You got a taste for it and started to see what that could then bring.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So when was that? How old were you at that stage?
I was 16 at the time. I was a man child. When I was 12, I was pretty much the same size as I am now. I was one of those kids that everybody used to point at and go, that he's not 12. Like, I want to see his passport. I was one of those. I had hair on my chest at the age of 12. I was a fully developed man. But I was, like I said, I was probably better than all the other kids at sport just because I was physically developed earlier. I'm not necessarily because I was any better than anybody else.
So when you started to realise that you saw a taste, you were in an environment surrounded by lots of professional sports people, you started to get a taste of it, what made you suddenly shift to wanting to be the best? Did you notice any changes in your attitude, in your mental approach, your physical approach?
I just think obviously I'm just a stubborn person. Only when they do those quizzes and they ask you, you know, name, star sign, favourite colour, favourite movie, if you were an animal, what would you be? Most people say lion because I'm courageous or whatever. I'll probably be a donkey or a mule or something else equally as stubborn. Like, not that flattering, but I'm like ultimately an incredibly stubborn person. And yes, whilst that has its negative connotations, also it helps because I become very single-minded in what I'm trying to achieve. And once I got a taste of it, I then wanted to be the best. I wanted to be better than the other guys in my team, and I wanted to be better than the guys in the other team. And then with that, along the way, you know, fame, money, success, acclaim, it was like, so it became quite enjoyable. Whilst I never truly loved cricket, I certainly loved the success and love in achieving and being told well done. I think everybody liked that.
Yeah. It's really interesting that you liked the sport. You've just said you never really truly loved it yet. It was the start, really, of your career, of you being a well-known person and for you to have that success and recognition that you wanted. So I'm very surprised at that because you think about all these sports people because you have to give up quite a lot when you're a sports person. Like you just said, you know, when you're stubborn, which from a positive point of view means you're very single-minded and you can focus on the things that you want to do. But ultimately, you do have to make a lot of sacrifices. So it's interesting that you're able to do that to achieve the success in a sport that probably was your second love behind rugby. Would that be a fair comment?
I'm not even sure it was my second. I think it might have come in third or fourth or something like that. I preferred fighting. I prefer rugby sevens. I know it's basically rugby as well. But I would say it was my third or fourth favourite sport. But I'm not saying I would have been good enough to be professional at all the others by any stretch of the imagination. I think I did grow to love trying to be the best at cricket as opposed to the actual game of cricket. I did love trying to be better than other people at it, and I enjoyed the whole idea of being a professional cricketer. I didn't necessarily love the game. I just didn't actually. I wouldn't choose in my spare time to go and have a game of cricket on the bench.
Yeah.
I would probably do something else. But I love trying to be the best, but not necessarily love cricket.
What came with trying to be the best? Because obviously there's the physical side, which often seems to be the obvious thing, certainly when it comes to sport. A lot of successful sports people are physically fit and will spend hours working on their fitness. But what else did you do? Did you have like mental preparation to make sure that you were the best within your team? What else came into that?
Well, ironically, I mean, I know I've just been here talking myself up, saying what an amazing sports person I was, but I actually wasn't that talented at cricket. So I feel that my edge in cricket, albeit I'm a very physical athlete, so in rugby I was very physical. I was physically a lot stronger than most of the other cricketers, but it's not a big advantage to be strong in cricket. as in some other sports.
Yeah.
So I feel that my biggest asset came in my mind, in that I worked out straight away that I'm not the most dexterous person. I don't have amazing skill. Yes, I was physically strong, but that doesn't necessarily give you an advantage in cricket like it does in fighting or rugby, where those you really rewarded for being physically superior to someone else. And there's still advantage, of course. Yeah. But whilst I lacked of some of the skill of some of my counterparts, I feel like I made up for that with my mental strength. That was, I used to practice a lot of self-hypnosis. I sort of worked out put on physically as strong as any cricketer's probably ever been. And that's not making me the best player in the world. I'm not as skillful as some of these other guys. So where can I get a jump on them? So I sort of turned my self-hypnosis. I quickly realised that preparing myself mentally would give me an advantage. So I really concentrated on the mental aspect of the game and toughness. I mean, ironically, my mental toughness came a lot of the time by pushing myself in training. More, most people thought I was doing it to get physically stronger, but I think more than that, it was just myself pushing myself to want to do things which I didn't want to do, which I felt gave me a mental edge over the other people. So a lot of people thought I was doing a physical training to try and gain a physical improvement, but it was more a way of me strengthening myself mentally, I think. And there were mental skills I did as well. Like I've mentioned, I did some self-hypnosis and visualization and controlling my arousal levels, how excited I got, nervous or anxious, controlling all that stuff. So those things I felt that I had to improve on to be able to compete.
So was hypnosis a part of all of that? Visualization obviously is a very powerful, just hearing you talk about controlling like the arousal side, the nerves, the excitement, did that come with the hypnosis or was there something else that you did to help with that?
Well, it's all closely interlinked, but I really made a conscious effort to try and find myself. I mean, when you wake up in the morning and you're all drowsy, it would be the wrong time to attempt to go and entertain a crowd of 100,000 people. You need to get yourself from that sleepy state into a state which is optimum for you to be able to access the hours and hours, thousands of hours of training you've done to execute the skills which you've learned, whether that be singing or talking in front of a crowd or playing cricket or fighting, whatever that is. You've got to become acutely aware of your anxiousness versus how relaxed you are and try and find the optimum state that you can be in to access all that training that you've done to execute the skills which you've practiced so much. So I sort of became really conscious of that, and I took that through my career, and I really found it a massive advantage for when I eventually became a professional fighter.
So
those skills to this day, like I can get up and talk in front of, not that I'm likely to be asked to, but I could get up and speak at Parliament.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be nervous. I'd control my, I don't know the first thing about politics, but I'd get up. I'd get up and I wouldn't be nervous because I'd control that anxiety probably better than most people do because I've trained at it so much. And I'm not better than anybody else. It's just some people train their whole lives to become doctors. Yeah. Some people train their whole lives to become lawyers. If you do something every day, you become good at it. If you play PlayStation, you become really good at PlayStation. Me, I've just really practiced controlling my arousal levels. There's a couple of emotions that people think I was born with that, and that's like anxiety and nerves. But I do get it. I just control it.
Yeah.
And then the other one, I don't get embarrassed about things because I think maybe that's just used for being controlling my anxiety. I think people think I was born without the part of the brain that controls embarrassment, especially my teenage daughter. she said, you must have been born without that part of the brain, the amount of embarrassment.
I embarrass Max and Jono all the time. I love it. The skill that to control that emotion is pretty phenomenal because all of us will have anxiety and fear at some point. And it's the biggest thing that holds people back. It's the killer of dreams. And so to be able to do that gives you the edge. And so was that a combination of using your hypnosis with calming that whole system down and visualizing the success and the training that you already had and combining the two to have that belief in yourself. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think visualization and hypnosis are closely related. I think if you practice, like I said, you know, I play PlayStation. I have to look down at the controller, see which one's the jump button or which I don't play. I've never played it, so I don't play very much. My kids play me. They beat me because they just play so much of it. They don't even have to look down. They can, without even looking down at the button, they can know which button to push, and they do it subconsciously. I've just practiced that a lot, and I'm no different to anybody else. You just do something a lot, you become good at it. So people go, oh, you're amazing. You've been this athlete and you're this athlete. And I'm like, well, I'm not really. I've just done a lot of it. So yeah. I've just done it a lot. If anyone does something a lot, they become good at it. And people go, oh, you could have done anything. You could have played any, you know. You could. I said, well, I have some fundamental things which are useful for sport. Strength, speed, coordination. Those are the backbone of all sports. But I struggled at school. I wasn't great at exams. I wasn't very good at learning. Whereas other people, someone who goes and becomes a doctor, they're just intelligent people. If they'd concentrated, instead of being a doctor, they'd become a lawyer. They could have become a chartered accountant. They could have become a politician. They just chose to put their intelligence in that particular direction.
Yeah.
So I don't know why it would be such a surprise that someone could do several different sports. It's just, that's what it is. Like, just as the lawyer could become a doctor if he so wished.
We could all do anything if we put our mind to it, in fairness. Yeah.
I don't think I'll make a jockey. I'm 100, 106.
Well, maybe not. Yeah. Unless it was a massive.
Good point.
Yeah.
Massive. It's an elephant.
But it's so true. And, you know, you just touched on the positive sides of it. You know, if you do something enough, you are good at it. And this is true on the negative side. Like, quite often people will succumb to fear or talk themselves out of stuff, and they do it on a day-to-day basis and they become really good at it. So then when they're challenged to step out of that, they don't know what to do because their normal state or their normal way of thinking is on lack or negativity or on can't. And so you're really proving that if you focus on the things that you want and you do it consistently, then you start to form new habits and it starts to become natural, like with your kids with the PlayStation controllers, you with that natural ability to visualize and bring everything together before your games or your fights and to ensure that you are at that optimum level. We can all do it. We're living proof right now that we can all do it. It's just not necessarily the right outcome. It's often more negative than more positive.
Absolutely. It's ironically, we spend so much of our time at school learning Latin or cooking, I mean, whatever. Like things, a lot of stuff that we learn at school isn't particularly useful in the world. But I think training yourself to think and shut down thoughts that you don't want. I'm back in coaching, I'm back in cricket and I'm coaching. And one of the ways I'm finding to reach my players, a lot of them, we're all familiar with our phone. We're living on them. And I say your mind is like your phone. And the more windows that you have open, the slower your phone moves, the more battery it uses, the worse it works. So you've got to learn to shut down windows. Shut them down when you're not using them and focus on what you're focusing on. If that program's not running well because you're allowing other emotions in, then you're not doing yourself the right service. You're not allowing your phone to run at its best. So that's effectively like having a virus.
Yeah,
on your computer. You need to clear those thoughts and don't allow those negative emotions into your mind. Just shut them out. I always say, with my visualization, I've got a guy who has followed me around all my life. I used to call him Dave. He sits on my shoulder and he says, "You can't do this. You can't do that." I'd be batting and I'd be like, "I've got to play really sensibly here." And then Dave would shout in my ear, "Try and whack a six. Try and hit it out of the oval." And I had this constant fight with Dave my whole life. And then when I went to fight, or sometimes when I'm talking to someone, I don't like the way they're talking to me. I don't like their manners.
Yeah.
Dave's telling me, just tell him to shut up and go away. But then I'm constantly fighting with Dave to say, you know, no, treat this guy with respect, hear what he's got to say. And we all have a Dave or someone sitting on our shoulder. Ironically, my ex-wife, when she left, her new boyfriend's called Dave. So I said, well, you've got him now. So now I don't call him Dave. I call him the enemy sitting on my shoulder.
Yeah.
So out of respect to my ex-wife partner. Yeah. So it's like we all have the enemy sitting on our shoulder.
We do. And it's what we do with that voice. I call them my monkeys. You call them Dave. But the other people call them niggles or whatever. We all have that inner voice that goes, you can't. Why do you think that you're any better than anybody else or you can't do this? It's what you do to drown it out. You know, with the self-hypnosis, with the visualizations. It's all about retraining your mind to move beyond that, to focus on the important stuff. Because that's just fear-based, which is false.
Yeah, and it is. I mean, one of the first things you learn in visualization is to, I started out, I'm really one-dimensional visualizer. Mine was along the lines of, I want to visualize myself doing a movement, a cricket shot, correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Every now and then, Dave would throw an image in there of me getting out or playing a bad shot. I would always say, no.
Yeah.
And I would erase that shot and I would screw it up. It was a picture of me doing it. I'd screw it up and throw that piece of paper in the bin and then go away and I'd do it correctly. I'm not a psychologist or a psychotherapist or anything like that, but I've since applied it to other elements of my life. And when I start thinking negatively about certain events or ways of thinking, then I do the same thing. I start thinking it and I go, no, this is a dead-end game. Don't buy into this thinking bad things about other people, because the only person who's suffering is myself.
Yeah.
It's my thoughts, it's my brain. It doesn't have no effect on me how, if I don't like someone, I don't waste any time thinking about that. I screw that thought up and I throw it in the bin because it's a dead end game. The only person that's punishing, I'm not, me sitting there wishing them bad isn't making them any less likely to have bad things happen. And it's just consuming my time. So I don't play that game. I used to spend hours wasting my life. People have done wrong by me wishing that bad stuff would happen to them. I just don't play that game. It's a dead end game.
Yeah, so true. Yeah. And it's refreshing to hear you say that, because so often we get caught up in it. We need to just let it go. Control the controllables and let the rest go.
Well, that was ironically the saying, control the controllables, was the saying for our Surrey team throughout a successful period.
Really?
That was literally our go-to motto, control the controllables. People would be sitting there going, oh, it's going to rain. It's going to, you know, this is going to affect us. And I'd say, well, unless anyone's got a direct line to the big man upstairs, then we just best let it go, because we can't control it. If it's going to rain, it's going to rain. So we can't worry about that. And there's other things in life. There's so many things in life that we can't control. Exactly. Can't control other people's behavior. So we just have to learn to not worry about it and focus on improving ourselves rather than wishing things that we can't control. It's wasting. It's like, again, that's having too many programs running on your phone. You've got to shut those down. You can't control it. Shut it down so your phone or your mind can run at its best.
Awesome. You've just given me so many little nuggets already and kind of tied in all the questions I was going to ask you about your mental prep with your sport, but also not just cricket. You've brought in your coach and as well as your fighting. If you don't mind, just bring it back to Ben at the moment, because obviously you said growing up, you and him were like best friends. I traveled a lot when I was younger and I get that whole sense of the consistency of having that one friend who's your companion with you. What was it like playing alongside him and both being a part of the England and the Surrey team together? Did he have a different love for cricket to you, or was it a similar approach?
No, I think we were both the same. He was the same. He was a multi-talented sportsman as well. He played for England schools, rugby, hockey, golf and cricket.
Oh, wow.
So he was a very talented sportsman as well. But I don't feel that he loved cricket more than anything else. But I think we certainly enjoyed being international sportsmen. We certainly enjoyed that together, probably too much. So I loved playing together with him. He was best friend. We lived together. We both went to boarding school together. We lived together. We were young. We traveled in caravans together. We did everything together. So it was probably the best days of my life, I'd say.
It was always so inevitable then that you would play together an international stage, which is something that only three other brothers have done, isn't it, in England cricket?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I know it's not many. I know that we've got Sam and Tom Curran who have just done it in this last winter. They're both Surrey players as well and friends of mine as well, so that's fantastic. So I know not too many people have done it, and we're pretty fortunate. I think that we were even aware at the time, as young as we were and everything like that, I think we were aware it was a special time in our lives and that we were going through and achieving something special. So we were pretty aware of that. I don't think we knew where the ride was going to end.
Yeah.
But we knew that whilst we were in it, that it was a pretty unique scenario.
You've just spoken about your mental prep with everything. Did that help with overcoming the loss of him in some capacity? Obviously, it's a totally different approach. But did that help? Because, I mean, you were at the peak of your career. He was just, I suppose, more at the start because he was younger. You were back in Australia visiting family when he was tragically killed. If you don't mind, could you just share sort of how you coped with that whole aftermath of it all within the sport, because that was something you did together, and then within life in general?
Well, firstly, look, I'm no different to anybody else. I'm not sure who listens to your podcast, but I can pretty much guarantee that everyone, a very large majority of the people on your podcast, will have lost someone. Mm. So I'm not unique in that regard. Yes, maybe higher profile than most of the people, but I'm the same. I love my brother, and probably more than anyone else in the world at that particular time. So he was my dearest, the dearest person to me. So, and I'm not alone there. I mean, I think the problem is one of the things that we encounter when that happens is we feel like we're the only person that's gone through this. And human reaction, nature to feel hard done by, and it's bad. It's not something you go, oh, well, it happens. It'd be inhuman if you responded in that way. So for me, it was the second, I mean, I lost my grandparents, but, you know, this was the cycle of life, and you expect that to happen. We expect our elders to die before, our parents to die before us. I think it's an unusual, you're not expecting to bury a sibling or a child. I think that's not the cycle of life. So from that perspective, when it happened, it was so unexpected. And we had so many plans to do so many more things. I think it's panic more than anything. You don't know how to react. You're not skilled in controlling those such strong emotions. Like I said, if you do something a lot, you get good at it. But these things are so rare in life.
Of course.
They're new to it. So I lost my best friend in a car accident 5 years prior to that. Graham Kersey, who also played cricket for Surrey and was our wicketkeeper at Surrey. And he dropped me to the airport out here, where I live now, out here in Brisbane, and he dropped me to the airport. And then by the time I landed in England, he had had his car accident. And so for me, that was the first time I'd ever suffered anything like that. Before that, I was 20. I was 25 at the time when that happened.
Mm.
And I say that suffering is all relative to whatever you've been through in your life prior to that. If you take a toy off a favorite toy off a two-year-old, they go to pieces, they cry. Because that's the worst thing that's ever happened to them.
Yeah.
Then after a while, they start growing up. They go, hang on, my dad, my mum takes my toy off me and I go to pieces. But hey, it's all right, I'll get it back. Eventually, they don't cry over small things. They don't fall over just falling over. These reactions are shock most of the time. So when my best friend died, that was shock to me. And I was in a whole range of emotions I didn't know what to deal with. And then again, with my brother, it's such a rare and shocking thing. You don't know how to deal with it. And I still think I'm learning. I still think I'm really learning. It's only probably goes with Sarah in the last couple of years that I've truly come to terms with losing people. I don't know why that is, but I think I've just come to the conclusion that this is just life. It's like people say to me, oh, it's so sad, what happened to your brother? And I'll go, not really. It's life and life's term. That's what happens to all of it. So I tried to change the way I've got a saying, if you don't like something, change it. If you can't change it, change the way you think about it. So I don't like the traffic in the morning. So I can sit there and I complain all my life. I can complain, but that's not going to change it.
Mm.
I can write to the council and complain about it. At least I'm doing something proactive. If the council can't do anything about it, then really I need to change the way I think about it and just turn my stereo up and enjoy my ride. So you can't change ultimately when you lose someone. You can't change that. So you need to change the way you think about it. Only recently that I changed about it. It's life and life's terms. People say it's sad. I go, not really. It's not sad. Mm. It's just life. It's the cycle of life. We all die. Mm. And since I've changed, that's a sort of it's aggressive way of thinking about it. So I tried to get all defensive and tell, I don't feel sad. You've got to replace those thoughts with something. So I chose to replace my thoughts with an aggressive response.
Mm.
It's not sad.
it's just life, and it happens to all of us. So why should I be any different to anyone else? Why would I be not have to suffer in life? I should have to suffer too. There's other people. When my brother died, it's actually, so I always say, like, be humble or life will cast humbleness upon you. I had always, that's sort of one of my favorite sayings. And prior to my brother dying and my best friend dying, I was pretty arrogant and pretty happy with myself. And this gentleman come to me all the time and say, oh, hey, Adam, we're trying to raise money for a hospice. I'm like, mate, I'm busy. I'm kind of like, I'm important here. I'm like captain of England. I'm a pretty important guy. What do you want? Do you want me to sign a photo for you? I want to talk to you about this hospice for children with terminal illness. Mate, I'm kind of busy. Hey, I'm like important guy. I was like pretty caught up in my own world. Then after Graham died and my brother died, this gentleman came again one day and he said, oh, you know, I want to talk to you about that. And I was like, let me see what this is about. I don't know why I was open to it more at that stage. I think I was just defeated. Yeah. So I went to see this guy and I went there and there was mums there and their children had died and their children all were dying and they were dealing with it. And then I was like, who the hell am I? Who am I to, they're suffering the same as I am. And why do I feel any more important than anybody else? Their children are dying. And that then I feel that I changed that day. I feel that I said to God, what can I do? How can I help? How can I get involved? And then that really made me, I felt like maybe I started to grow up a little bit that day.
Yeah.
So I don't know, there's so many emotions. And even now I'm talking about it, I can feel that, again, talking about arousal levels, I can feel that
it's
such a strong subject that I get slightly emotional still talking about it, even though I'm far more in control than I used to be. So
I think that's the thing with grief, though. It hits you at any time, doesn't it? You know, I'm in control of this. And then, bam, suddenly you're not. Mm. But that's normal. Okay, if you don't want to talk about it, then please say, because...
No. I talked before about when I played a bad shot or did something wrong, I'd always go, no, screw it up in the bin and throw it away. So when I'd start thinking negatively and focusing on the actual moment of my brother dying and losing him,
yeah,
it took me a long time. I had to do that. It's like the biggest sinking feeling.
Yeah.
You wake up in the morning and you think about it, and your heart just sinks. It's just that hollow feeling. And you're just like, but when I focused on that for a year, maybe 2 years, I don't know, a long time, I can't remember. But then when I started replacing those thoughts with, why am I focusing on the five, or however long, that period of him dying? He died instantly. His car hit a brick wall and he died instantly. Why am I focusing on that moment when he had 24 amazing years with him? We did things together which people don't get to do. Why am I focusing on that moment? Why don't I focus on the 24 years beforehand, which were amazing memories, and be thankful for having the opportunity to do that? So it was an aggressive reaction to a response again. It's a replacing the thoughts rather than don't think about that, because I don't think you can stop thinking about something. I think you need to replace and change the way you think about it. So anytime I'd think about it, why did it happen? I'd change that with, wow, I was so lucky to have him. 24 years. I was so lucky to do the things we did. So now that's the way I think about it. I don't look now and think it was sad. I just go, wow, how good was that?
Yeah.
That time we spent together. That was amazing. And I also get a bit jealous because he died when he was 24. And we always used to have a competition who was better looking, him or me. I always say I was better looking. He claims he is. But I'm figuring now, every time I look at pictures of him, he's 24. He still looks so, he looks handsome. I'm struggling a bit now. I'm getting a bit old. So it's like, so I'm thinking he's got me covered now. So I kind of laugh when I think about it. I go, he had the final say.
And that's lovely, because that's like a unique thing that you two had together. And so that forms a beautiful memory for you that puts a smile back on your face. And, you know, that takes real courage to have that reframe. And obviously it takes time with any of these things. Time is a healer. But to flip it from that 5 minutes of agony, well, obviously longer, but the 5 minutes that you were focusing on for those couple of years versus the 24 years that you had with him is an amazing way, because that's how he would have wanted you to remember him.
Yeah.
But, you know, how did that then affect you on the cricket pitch? Bearing in mind you lived together, you played for Surrey together and you played for England. Was that must have been tough.
Yeah, it's ironic because I don't know how many of your podcast listeners are cricket fans, but actually the most successful I ever was on the cricket field was immediately after the death of my brother. That was the most successful period.
Wow.
And people were saying to me, wow, you are like so tough that you are able to go and do that. And I was like, I was quite happy to take the blame, but I knew it differently. I just knew my fear of failure was completely removed, for failure on a cricket field is nothing compared to the pain that I was going off of the field. So going out, I just went out and played the game with freedom because I had no fear of the consequences of a game of cricket. It was put in context. I then later spoke to psychologists about it, and they say it's actually quite a common thing for people after suffering like something like that to come out and play the best they play, because they play without fear of consequence. Yeah, it was a pretty weird thing to me. I couldn't understand why it was going on. I actually felt guilty about it.
Right.
I shouldn't be doing this well. I should be suffering. For whatever reason, that was the most successful I ever was.
How did you cope with that guilt? Was that, again, were you able to squash it in the way that you did, or were you able to use it on the pitch in a form of anger and aggression? Like to, I don't know.
Like I said, I wasn't totally familiar with why it was happening. I was quite happy to go with it. And I actually remember walking out onto the pitch, I used to say it, after the first month of me having this really big success, I used to walk out on the pitch and I used to announce to the other people on the field, nothing more dangerous than a man with nothing to lose. They think I thought I was crazy because I came out and I just played, and they were genuinely, I don't know if intimidated is the right word, but they were probably more thrown from their own game by being concerned with what this guy who didn't care if he got out or not. He was like, quite distracts people from their own performance, worrying about what crazy guy's going to do.
Yeah.
So I was quite happy to play up on that. And I don't know at the time I was using it to my advantage, but it was kind of, like I said, like I find that you retreat in times of hurt, or if you feel that your safety or whatever is attacked, we tend to retreat. But I've found in the last few years, and I look back, it's like when I've attacked, when I felt like I want to retreat, to attack is often, I mean, I'm talking mentally now, I'm not talking physically, is the best, often a really powerful way of dealing with negative emotions.
Yeah.
So instead of just going, don't think about those negative emotions, don't think about those negative thoughts, it's like replace those thoughts with, you know, really aggressive philosophy, which you then ingrain into your mind, rather than trying to run away from the negative thoughts, try and be proactive and replace them with positive thoughts.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's powerful stuff and it's so tragic, and I really do appreciate you sharing this because it is very personal. So thank you for that. You mentioned obviously that immediately after you had your best season or your best spell with cricket, you then retired in 2007, is that right?
Well, I've retired a few times. I retired in 2004, but then I came back in 2007 to play. So I was only 31, 32 when I retired, which is pretty young. I walked away from the game probably off the back of that. Yeah, off the back of that, which again was another example of me retreating. That sort of led to the probably the unhappiest period of my life immediately after retiring. I think every time, it's actually quite good for me to talk about this because I've never really spoken about it for a while, but I feel like now compartmentalizing my thoughts is like retreating in these moments is a natural thing.
Yeah, of course.
I'm now, when I think back, like any big step or gain I've made is when I've attacked those emotions and replaced them. And I know I've already said this already, but it's just become sort of evident to me whilst on this podcast.
I mean, obviously you had that high and then almost kind of came crashing, I suppose, and then you retired and then you came back. So did you come back because you felt you had more to give, or that you hadn't finished what you needed to, or you wanted to do it for Ben? What was your thoughts on coming back?
I think I've made about 7 or 8 comebacks. I would like to say that there was some deep psychological reason behind it, but this is Graham Gooch, who was probably one of my favourite cricketers.
Yeah.
He asked me to come back and play, and I thought it would be a challenge. I'm also, like I said, I'm stubborn and I love accepting a challenge. So I chose to do it. I was asked again to come back and play in 2009 in the IPL, and I was going to do that, but I declined from it. And I've retired so many times from fighting, I can't even count. So I wasn't, there's certainly never been a case of trying to do anything for Ben. Or after we won the championship, everyone, a lot of the media and that wanted to make out that we had won the championship and I'd done so well and I dedicated my season for my brother. I don't know. For me, I always find that a little bit, I don't know. It's like, I would never have said that myself because I find that disrespectful, that feeling that something is really trivial as a game of cricket in comparison to the life of my brother.
Yeah.
I don't feel that like going out and being successful on the cricket field in any way replaces or does anything for the fact that I'd lost my brother. So I would never trivialise his death by dedicating on-field glory to something as serious as that. But people have no doubt said that that's the case and, you know, hey, that is what they did. It is what it is. But that's not what I ever certainly thought.
Did that impact on you when people were saying that? Obviously, when people say that, their intentions is often well-meaning, but it's often not really thought of on that deep level, like you've just said. But did it impact on you?
Not really. I mean, I think the thing is, I think I'd been already in the media for quite a substantial period of time when my brother died. I've been involved in newspapers, all sorts of TV and whatever since for 10 years. So I don't feel that impacted on me. I'm pretty much of the opinion that people were going to say what they want. Mm. When my dad said to me, if you actually knew how little people talked about you, you wouldn't worry about it.
Yeah.
So he told me that from a young age. And now if I see stuff written in the media about me, which is incorrect, I used to worry about it. But I think by the time that came, I was 31 and stuff would be written about me, which was nonsense or whatever. And I kind of just go, you know, hey, that's what they want to write. No one, people read that for the day and then it's chip paper the next day. And by that stage, I was black belt status of ignoring stuff in the media. Yeah. So didn't worry about it. I mean, some of the stuff I heard was just nonsense, but you don't worry about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not disregarding it. I'm not saying, you know, I was amazing, because if I'd been challenged with that same thing at the age of 20, 21, I don't think I would have been able to deal with it. It was just fortunate at that stage in my life, I was well-versed in that, dealing with that. So.
Yeah. Will it become a part of your career? Again, like you say, you know, when you experience these things, it becomes a part of you living your life in the media. Isn't normal to most people, but for you it is. And so when it comes to media, unfortunately, there is a lot of BS that comes along with that. And again, it's that choice, isn't it, of how to respond to it and whether to let it in. And by choosing not to, then people around you, people who know and love you, they know that a lot of this is... And that's the important stuff.
And I think also, I mean, I don't know how many of your listeners would have to deal with that, but I can't imagine. I look on at like other people when they go through hard times, in like famous people, and I go, wow, how do they deal with it? But it helps me now get through any hard times that come my way. I sort of mentioned before about a kid crying because their toy has been taken away. And that's the worst thing that's ever happened.
Yeah.
So now things which would bother most people, I can trivialize them by saying, hey, I'm not worried. I'm not scared of anything. Pretty much now the only thing I'm scared of, literally the only thing I'm scared of, is something happening to my children.
Yeah.
Outside of that, I can honestly put my hand on my heart and say, I'm not fearful of anything. I'm not scared of dying. I'm not scared of illness. I'm not scared of financial ruin. I'm not scared of losing my parents because they're old now and they've had a good life. I'm not scared of dying myself, but I've only become a product. I've evolved into that because of the loss which I've suffered. So when you suffer, you grow.
Yeah.
And there's a saying in sport that either something that I used to say was, you either win or you grow. You don't lose. It's the same in life. You're either winning in life, or when bad stuff happens, you're growing.
Yeah.
So I feel that those things that have happened to me have built a resilience in me, which now enables me to walk around with such peace, because I'm not scared of it. I can honestly say I'm not scared of very, I'm just assuming the health of my children and them being happy. And if they're all good, then life's good. Because I know that whatever happens, my brother died. The next day I woke up, hey, guess what? The sun came up and I have smiled again since then. I've had enjoyed. Sometimes I drive to coach kids cricket, and on the way there, a nice song comes on in the car, and I enjoy that song.
Yeah.
And then I stop and I get a coffee, and I enjoy that coffee. And then when I go there, I have some nice interactions with people that I'm coaching, and there's other coaches. And on the way back home, I spent having some nice conversations with some friends. And then the end of the day comes, and I look back, I've had 10, 20 enjoyable moments throughout the day, which gives me happiness.
Yeah.
And, you know, happiness isn't some large and looming thing. Like, if we make it to the end and my brother's still here, then I'll be happy. Yeah. It's not some large looming event on the horizon. Happiness is lots of little everyday things which you can stop and enjoy.
Yeah.
That's happiness. So I've now learned that whatever goes wrong, you'll still always be happy. You'll still always have these small little things which form your day, which provide happiness. So I'm not fearful of anything.
Yeah, just hearing you say, you know, when you're learning, I love. The gratitude piece is massive. And quite often, at the end of the day, people are too quick to focus on what they didn't do or what hasn't happened. Rather than being present in that moment and focusing on all those things that you just mentioned about the songs, the interaction, the lovely coffee.
Can't forget the coffee.
Yeah, can't forget the coffee. But they're all things that make you happy, and you're acknowledging that. And I think it's so important to acknowledge these, because small things lead to big things. House, you start with one brick, it then comes lots of bricks to then form an amazing house, whatever. It all starts with little things, and if you can acknowledge the little things, then you start to feel a bit more at peace and a bit more abundant in your life, regardless of what you're going through or what you've been through. And I think that's amazing what you've just said. And it is a really important reminder for everybody that's listening, for me, for everyone. It is the small things that all add up, definitely. It is. Be in that moment and be gracious for it.
I don't know. There's a movie that I watched a while back. I think it was Adam Sandler movie. It's called Click.
Right.
It's about a guy. He has a remote control. And I went out to watch it because I felt like I wanted to laugh. Mm. And so basically this guy has a remote control for his own life, and he can fast forward through the bits which he doesn't like. So, you know, I don't like exams, I'll fast forward through that. Got the flu, I'll fast forward through that, blah, blah, blah. And then in the end, one day, he just keeps fast forwarding through all these times in his life where life isn't perfect.
Yeah.
Next minute, he's there and he looks and he's, I got this thing out to have a laugh.
Yeah.
And next minute, I'm bawling in my lounge room. I'm like, oh my God, this thing is just giving me the meaning of life. And so he's just fast forwarded through his whole life. Because every time moment life wasn't perfect, he goes, I'll skip this bit.
Yeah.
You've got to enjoy those rides. You've got to enjoy those bits. You've got to enjoy suffering. You've got to enjoy that's part of the ride too. It's like getting on a roller coaster. And I say my life is a roller coaster. I have massive highs and massive lows.
Yeah.
I'm only going to enjoy it when the ride's not scary, then I'm not getting my money's worth. So when the ride's bad, when it's bad, just throw your hands in the air and enjoy that ride. Just enjoy that too. Enjoy the suffering. Like, it's an aggressive attitude towards pain and struggle, but I enjoy, and I said, it might be a little bit bullshit, it might be a little bit wanky, but can you say that in England? In Australia, we use it all the time. I used to have a nightmare when I was a kid, a recurring nightmare, and I was terrified of it. I didn't know what the nightmare was. All I know is I'd wake up and I'd run to my mum and dad's room, and they'd be, what is it? And all I remember was, I used to say spinning wheels, something to do with spinning wheels. So I didn't know what it was. Anyway, I got to about 12 and I was like, I've had enough of this dream. I'm not scared of it anymore. In fact, I want to dream about it tonight. I want to dream about that dream because I want to know what it is. I don't know what it is. I want that dream. So when that dream comes, I'm not just not scared of it. I'm looking forward to that nightmare. I want that nightmare. Never had it again. Never ever had that nightmare again. And I figure that's the way to harping on it is like, when you feel pain, don't retreat, confront it. And that's my motto.
Brilliant. You've shared so much. It's been educational for me. It's been awe-inspiring for me. I could talk to you for absolutely hours. I might have to get you back on because I've got so many other questions I want to ask you.
We can do that. I'll come back. I love hearing my own voice.
I do. I think the way that you describe things is very simple, very raw, and it's very, very true. When it comes to tragedy, when it comes to success, in this episode, we've spoken about the highs of representing your country and representing it with your best friend and your brother and the lifestyle that that gave you, to the absolute lowest of when you lost him and your best friend and the aftermath of that. And it just shows that it doesn't matter what you see in social media or on the TV, there's always a story in everyone's lives, and we've all got our own battles and our own journeys, and life is very up and down. And what you do in that moment, like you've shared with us today, is powerful stuff. And it's something that we can all learn from, because when you say, like, often people retreat, it's that natural thing to do. But when you have that attitude of, like you said, you know, when you're someone with nothing to lose, you have that freedom almost in that moment to just be you with no limitations, no boundaries, no emotional attachment, because you've got nothing to lose. And suddenly that's when magic happens with your career, and it opens you up to that. And so it's really, really powerful stuff. I think, I know of, since your retirement, you've gone on, like you've mentioned that you're coaching the cricket team now. You've been involved in property development. What I gather, you were also in Afghanistan when there was terror attacks or something that was taking place. I mean, your life has continued to be very, very, very much a roller coaster, and you're riding that wave.
I was having a chat the other day to God, and I was like, you know what? I wouldn't mind just getting off the roller coaster and going on the merry-go-round for a little bit, because I'm like, my nerves are shot, you know, but I don't think I can go on the merry-go-round. I'm kind of like, I'm used to the roller coaster, and I'm like I said, I'm not scared of it anymore. Like, when you see people go on roller coasters and they start throwing their hands up in the air and enjoying it, then the roller coaster holds no fear for them anymore.
Yeah, it becomes exhilarating. Because also on top of that, I mean, you mentioned the hypnosis that you did as self-hypnosis, but you also do, you're qualified now for hypnotherapy, which I just think is amazing, because as a hypnotherapist myself, also someone who used hypnotherapy to help me get through trauma in my life, the power that that has is incredible. And I love the fact that you have now qualified for that. I think it's amazing.
Yeah, I did that just because I was such a big believer in, I did self-hypnosis myself, so I would get myself into a state of hypnosis, and I just know the benefits that it did for me. And then I saw this course for hypnosis, and I had some spare time, so I thought, I wouldn't mind doing that. I became fascinating, and something I'm like certainly glad I did. I thought at one stage I was going to try and use it to try and hypnotize the players into performing better. But my first job when I became a qualified hypnotherapist was with England. And I just thought, hey, I could become the most hated man in England if I like hypnotize Jimmy Anderson and he can't bowl anymore. So I thought, nah, I'll save it for, you know, maybe one of the under-12s or something like that. I'll mess his career up instead.
practice and then move on up. It's an amazing thing. And it shows, like I mentioned at the beginning, that you're almost sort of reinventing, but I would almost challenge that and say you're embracing life. And so you're kind of meeting life head on and just in taking opportunities and rolling with it and seeing what comes from it, but more importantly, learning from it and then using it in that next high and that next low. And I just love your attitude. I just think it's humbling, it's inspiring, it's amazing. Because you have gone through so much and you've sat here with a smile on your face the whole time I've been speaking to you. Obviously, the emotional part of you speaking.
I can see you rugged up there in your turtleneck jumper. And I'm sitting here. It's easy to smile. So I think that could be me over there in the cold.
I know. You know, you're coaching the England squad. So is that over in Australia or is it over?
Oh, no, I've resigned from that now. I was with England for 18 months, but I'm out of that now. And I'm coaching Queensland here. I've got three young children, so I'm back here coaching so I can be around them. And, well, I was going to say help them grow up. Help them grow up, but I think they're more mature than me. So.
Are they? Are you supporting talent?
Yeah, my daughter's a very talented athlete, and so is my youngest. My middle child is intellectual, so I don't know where that came from. He's actually in the top 0.1% of the population over here. He's getting ridiculous. He's a special, he's gone into a special sort of government initiative called STEM, where they take the most intelligent kids. I've got absolutely no idea where that came from, because I achieved nothing at school, and I married my ex-wife. I didn't marry her for a brain. I married her because she was hot. And then I was trying to think where I was at the time when he was conceived, and I was like, no, all the Surrey players at the time as well, so it can't have been any of them. So I think it's just one of those throwbacks.
Yeah, well, intelligence comes in so many different forms, and you had proper intelligence with your sport, so maybe it's just transferred into a slightly different path for your son.
I think it's the milkman.
you know, it's amazing. Again, it just shows how different we all are, doesn't it? You know, how unique we are and how special and precious it all is. Yeah. But thank you so much. I really, really appreciate it. I normally end with mindset mantras, but you've said so many throughout this show that I need to go back and make a note of them. But do you have a particular one that you've perhaps not shared already that you could let people know that kind of got you in the zone?
No, I think I'm one of those people that has so many sayings. I'm like, I don't have the ability to remember anything. I struggle to remember my kids' names, but I seem to remember these meaningless things, you know, like be humble or life will cast humbleness upon you. And like I would say, my favorite one is that at the moment is, if you don't like something, change it. If you can't change it, change the way you think about it. And that to me is, that encapsulates everything. So that's literally how I'm living my life at the moment.
And I think that is my mantra moving into 2019. I think I'm going to take it and I'll think of you when I'm saying it. That is a powerful one and it's so true and it encompasses all areas of life. Whatever you do, do something to change that. We all have choice. We all have choice. If you don't like it, choose again. And if you don't like it, keep choosing until it feels right for you and in alignment with you. So honestly, I would love to have you back because I'm only halfway through my questions and I have so much I want to ask you. So let's hopefully try and get that arranged. But for now, thank you so much. It's been amazing. And I really appreciate you being so open and honest about is personal. So I appreciate you for trusting in me and letting me ask you these questions.
Thanks for having me on. Thank you.
That's all for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you've enjoyed this show, please head over to iTunes, subscribe and leave a review. Bye for now.